And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, once again in the other chair.
Don't need
I was going to come up with a wise
don't
crack,
need the label chairs.
So much happened today, I just thought I would just say something neutral, but I tell you, busy day and news, and my goodness, we could do the two-hour spectacular.
Ironically, we're not talking about news today.
No.
Anyway.
Well, sorry.
We can talk about some news.
Yes, we can.
That's true.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will be talking all about the environment. Tomorrow is Earth Day. A chance to reflect on all things environmental and raise awareness about climate change, clean water, clean air, sustainable living, and all the things that fall under the broad category of tree hugging. Anyway, helping with us, helping us out on all that today, we welcome Mike Schreiner, leader of the Green Party of Ontario and Guelph Green Party provincial nominee from 2014 and maybe 2018.
Well, we don't have nominations open yet, but we'll see.
It's a little early, but it doesn't hurt to ask.
I was fishing for a scoop. Mm. Anyway, thanks for joining us today, Mike. Glad to have you here.
Hey, pleasure, Adam. Scotty, it's a pleasure to be here. Can we talk about green jobs, too?
Sure.
Yeah, hugging and green jobs, both.
Yes. You know what? On the website, I listed like four categories, but frankly, I wasn't planning on following that.
Okay,
we're going to go where
what?
The wind... As per
but
since it's Earth Day, we're just going to go where the wind takes us.
Perfect.
Earth Day style.
Anyway, awesome.
I do want to talk about some news off the top because it came down an hour or so ago. I mean, it was going on all day, but they've wrapped up about an hour ago. Mike Duffy, Senator Mike Duffy, acquitted on all 31 counts. He's a free man, free to go back to the Senate. Any thoughts?
Free to be you and me, yeah. I'm not surprised. I had a bet on with somebody that he would walk away, and he did.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised, although the comments were reserved for Nigel Wright, though. It sounds like the judge was none too pleased with that fella.
Yeah, there was a lot of with the stuff with the judge. It was like, well, he was coerced into doing all these things. The rules for the Senate weren't murky. But the thing about the coercion was interesting because, and it comes down to the core point of the trial all along, was if he was coerced into doing something, shouldn't the coercers be on trial? I don't know if that's the word for
coercers. I like that.
Coercers.
Should patent that. Yeah.
The
check writers?
I'll call my lawyer after the show. But yeah, it just seems fascinating that, you know, yeah, he was acquitted, but it seems the judge... It's almost what happened with the Sona trial, right?
Yes.
Because Sona was like, oh, he was a cat spa. He was in on it. We have no idea who he was on it with, but we're going to throw him in jail for a year. And
what's your take, Mike? What do you
think? Well, I think the big issue here is we can't let an acquittal take away from the fact that the Senate needs overhauling. Like, mm-hmm. I think most Canadians agree with that, whether you support the Senate or not. It needs overhauled. Expenses need to be real-time disclosure, publicly reported. And we have to come up with a new way of selecting senators. I think the new government has improved the process. But I actually kind of like Elizabeth May's proposal, which is let's actually have an elected Senate and let's do it through proportional representation. And that's a great place to start experimenting with how proportional representation, a more democratic voting system would work. And so let's not forget that the Senate needs reformed big time.
I had the same idea about proportional representation. I wrote about it on the Open Sources site last summer. So I don't want to accuse Elizabeth May of stealing from me. But she wouldn't be the first. I'm just saying. Anyway, we're going to talk about environmental stuff, and it is Earth Day. And Mike, I'm going to start with this sort of more open question. It's Earth Day, which sort of makes you think birthday, and you know when your birthday comes around, you sort of think what's happened in the last year. How have I changed? How have I grown? What did I do? How have I made myself better or worse as you know consequence? So looking at this Earth Day versus last year. How do you think things have changed for good or ill in terms of our approach to green things and the environment?
Well, I think we've taken some steps forward and probably taken some steps back, too, just, you know, to be frank. And you know, my whole thing is, let's make every day Earth Day. Like, why do we really need a special day to actually protect the place we live, mm-hmm. our home? Like, I think everyone wants to keep their home clean most of the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it would be nice to live in a world where we actually don't even need an Earth Day. I think some of the positive developments over the last year is, I mean, I think the recognition that we're already suffering the effects of the climate crisis, I think people are really starting to feel it now. Ice storms, floods, wacky weather, like all of that we're experiencing. Our home insurance bills are going up. So we're seeing the negative effects of the climate crisis. And you know what? It's only going to get worse if we don't take action. And so the fact that in Paris, the world came together and said, you know what, we have to limit global temperature increases to 1.5 degrees Celsius, maximum 2, but let's shoot for 1.5. The fact in Ontario now, every political party supports some form of carbon pricing. Mm-hmm. That's a huge shift. I mean, I've been saying for decades that, you know, we should be talking about how we solve the problem and what kind of form of carbon pricing we need to bring forward, not whether we should do it. And so we've moved past whether or not climate change is a real issue, whether or not we have to price pollution, to what's the best way of pricing pollution. So that's a huge step forward. Some of the step backwards, from my perspective, is, you know, Liberal government's gutted the Endangered Species Act. You know, we had world-class endangered species legislation. They've gutted it. In 2011,
the provincial.
Yeah. This is provincial. Yeah, I'll focus mostly on provincial. The fact that in 2011, under huge pressure, a lot of people in Guelph were involved in this as well, is, you know, fighting the Melanctha Mega Quarry, which is, you know, at the headwaters of our watershed. The government caved under pressure and said, you know what, we'll review the Aggregate Resources Act. 5 years later now. Mm-hmm. Still no changes. They've reviewed it. We've had reports. We've talked about it. But a company could come in and propose something like the mega quarry tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain things around, like farmland protection, water protection, I don't think we have made advances on. I'm very excited to see us making advances on things like pricing carbon pollution. So it's been a good and bad year.
Fair enough. And I'm glad you mentioned Patrick Brown acknowledging the problem. And I think that's almost like a huge step, is the acknowledgement of the problem. And you see that in the United States. There's this, like, Jim Inhofe famously with the snowball. Look, global warming's a fraud. But, I mean, yeah, we caught Scotty off guard last week when we were talking about this, that, yeah, Patrick Brown at the PC convention said, it's a problem and we're going to have to deal with it. And even people of his own party there, I read people who were covering it and said, they're audible gasps, like, oh my God, he's gone green. It's
like, two people melted just hearing it, right? They just went, oh.
It was like one of those old, so, oh, like the somebody got the vapors and fainted. And, but, I mean, do you think he is legitimately on board with I don't know how much, if you've had like any kind of serious discussion with him, but on board with this, or is he like seeing the way the wind is blowing, and perhaps he's trying to modernize his party and maybe a more cynical?
Well, I think so one is, I think that it's an acknowledgement that carbon pricing is coming to Canada. It's coming globally. We have to take action. And the thing is, if we want to capture the opportunities in creating clean economy jobs, it's a $6 trillion economic opportunity. Even if Ontario captured 1% of that, it would actually be a larger contributor to our GDP than the auto sector is. Yeah. And so I think it's an acknowledgement that it's a serious problem. It needs to be addressed. And it's a huge economic opportunity if we move forward with a clean economy. And Guelph is so perfectly positioned to be the clean tech, clean hub leader in Ontario. I mean, we already are for the most part, and it's just about how do we advance that even further. So it has real positive benefits, you know, provincially, nationally, but also locally. And so I think it's an acknowledgement of that. I'm actually meeting with Patrick Brown tomorrow, as a matter of fact, on Earth Day of all days.
Wow.
And so I'll ask him your question personally.
Give him our number, too, if he wants to call.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Donaldson thinks you're a cynic. Prove him wrong.
But you know what? I think you have to take him at his word that you know, climate change is real, and the Conservatives are moving into the 21st century in 2016. They're only 16 years late. That's all.
Well, I do actually take him at his word. And like I said, you know, he caught a lot of people in his party off guard coming out and saying that. So, you know, it's I don't see what's in it for him to be disingenuous. But
I was going
to
say, it's almost like climate change in here. My green shirt's getting all sweaty.
I know. It's pretty warm in here. It's like a, yeah.
It is hot in this room.
Mitigate the climate change. Speaking of which, Mike, I was reading, but you were talking about Bill 172 and your sort of critique of that, I guess, and what could change. And something that was mentioned there was you said that the big polluter shouldn't get a free ride. Now, I get the impression that it sounds like there's going to be a point where the larger polluters were just going to sort of get a bunch of credits for nothing, or maybe not necessarily for a very low cost. Do you want to talk a bit about that and kind of explain where you are on that in terms of it? Sure. Sounds like everybody should probably pay the same as opposed to just sort of a giveaway for larger industries, which
sure.
I
so
agree
we,
with. But
yeah.
Anyway.
So we should be clear for your listeners. Bill 172 is the Liberals' cap-and-trade legislation, mm-hmm. which is their carbon pricing mechanism. It's before committee right now. As a matter of fact, they're going through clause-by-clause revisions to the bill right now. So my concern, first of all, is cap-and-trade systems are subject to gaming, and that's what's happened in the European Union in particular. And I don't want to see that happen here in Ontario. That's why the Green Party has been putting forward for many years now a much simpler, I think, more effective and straightforward proposal, which would be called carbon fee and dividend, which actually sets us up to tackle climate change and poverty at the same time. Essentially, it is put a fee on carbon pollution, make polluters pay for the damage they cause, take that money and give it back to the people of Ontario as a dividend. In a sense, I want my carbon check. And it actually could be the basis of providing a guaranteed annual income in the province. We think that's the way to go. The Liberals have chosen a different approach, cap and trade. And so, and that's where you sort of create this sort of kind of carbon market around trading permits to pollute, and you set a cap that emissions can't go above. So cap and trade can be effective, and I've acknowledged that, but it can only be effective if you design the system in a way where you don't allow industry exemptions and free pollution permits. And over 100 big of the biggest polluters in Ontario are being given free pollution permits mm-hmm. in the cap and trade legislation. And so how can it be effective if you're essentially saying, oh, it's free for you to pollute? Meanwhile, we're going to charge, people to fill up their car. They're going to pay more to heat your house. You're going to pay more if you're using fossil fuels. And so we think for the program to be effective, we can't give big polluters a free ride.
Well, isn't part of that, and I'm not siding with the big polluters, but the argument will be, as we've seen, and we'll probably get to it eventually, is that mm-hmm. they'll say that we can't improve the tech. A good example is Hamilton. I mean, to upgrade the steel there, it's like it wouldn't even be worth it. And of course, as we've seen, they have left. That's a whole other story. But isn't that the argument, though? It'll be like, well, there's no way we'd be able to improve this, so we're just going to go to Mexico because, well, they're not going to ask us to put scrubbers on or whatnot. So.
Right. So that is the argument. It's basically companies are saying we're trade exposed and we're going to have what's known as leakage. And I hate to use terms like that, but essentially what it means is that companies are saying, you know what, if we have to pay to pollute, we will move to another jurisdiction that's not going to charge us to pollute. Mm-hmm. So the Canada's Ecofiscal Commission, which is some of the leading economists in the country and has representatives from across the political spectrum, left, right, center, whatever, green, not green, they did a study that showed that only 2% of Ontario's economy is trade exposed to carbon leakage. And so maybe there's a case for the companies in that 2%, but certainly not a case for 100 of the biggest polluters. And so, it makes you wonder, so why are these people getting off, And mm-hmm. then we started getting into the whole, scandal that's happening now around the corporate donations going to the Liberal Party. And you start wondering, what is it? I don't know. Why are they getting an exemption when there's not an economic rationale to it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it almost seems like with the global economy, and this goes across a number of issues, not just environment, we're kind of – it always seems like we're stymied because we can't take aggressive action on things like wages or the environment or industry standards on safety and that kind of thing, because the threat is, well, then we'll leave and we'll lose good-paying jobs. And it's a tough predicament.
It is, and it's one of the reasons the Green Party is such strong supporters of small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, local entrepreneurs, innovation in our economy, because you know what? Let's support those people who are creating clean economy jobs, the jobs of the future. You know, I sort of look at it as it's my Wayne Gretzky approach to economics. Let's invest where the puck's going to be instead of where it is right now. Mm. And part of the problem right now with the Liberal government, provincial Liberal government's economic strategy is a lot of their business grants are going to existing companies that don't necessarily need the money.
Right.
And we should be supporting those cutting-edge companies, those new entrepreneurs, the people who are creating the jobs and providing the goods and services of the growing clean economy of the 21st century. And then we start getting ourselves out of this dilemma that, oh, well, you know, if you come in with, you know, some laws that actually protect the air we breathe or prevent us from suffering, you know, more from climate change, we're saying, like, sure, if you want to go somewhere else, go ahead, because we're creating all these other jobs in the parts of the economy that are growing.
It's more than government will, too. I mean, there are – we see this not necessarily in this part of the country, but, you know, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland, places where there is a huge resource-based economy. They're saying, like, no, you have to protect our jobs. You know, these are decent jobs. And this is the people talking. And the thing that always gets me is, and I don't know if maybe it's if you feel the same way, it's there seems to be this feeling that the green energy sector will eliminate all jobs. And it just seems like nobody understands that solar panels are manufactured, windmill parts are manufactured. There are other opportunities here, and it seems to be that there's some kind of mental block from people. Like, nobody wants to work in a coal mine. I used to think nobody would want to work in a coal mine, but apparently working in a coal mine is better than
starving.
Well, it's better than starving, but would you rather work in a coal mine or build solar panels?
Well, so first of all, a job is better than no job,
yes.
I think, for most people. But the reality is study after study after study has shown that investing in the clean economy, and depending on the sector, creates 2 to 7 times more jobs than the same amount of money invested in oil and gas and nuclear in the dirty economy. So already in Canada, we have more people working in renewable energy jobs than in the oil sands.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are where the jobs are. And so –
but we never hear about that.
But we never hear about that. And part of the reason we never hear about it is because those jobs are in thousands and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses all across the country and communities everywhere. And so instead of having it concentrated in, like, one place, like Fort McMurray, and big mega projects where you can say thousands of jobs are being created – that gets the headlines, but what doesn't get the headlines is all those small and medium-sized businesses and communities across the country that are creating, you know, maybe 100 jobs or 10 jobs or 1,500 jobs. And but that's where we build resiliency in our economy, because then you're not held hostage to one sector or one company.
Absolutely.
So along those lines, I guess we're talking a bit about energy and the greater oil and gas, nuclear, whatnot. Of course, everybody lost their minds this week when they found out their hydro bills were just going to go up. We've all done great strides at conservation.
Yeah.
And yet the power is going to go up, I don't know what it is, $3 or something, which doesn't sound like a lot. But, you know, everybody's always annoyed when the bill goes up. When you're trying so hard, you turn those lights off, you're not running this and that, the bill goes up. Now, one of the studies, or at least the analysis of it this week, was actually from an academic from this university, was that part of the reason why it's going up is due to the relationship between the government and what he called sweetheart deals between the wind and solar cabal, I guess let's call them. The sweetheart deals.
Who are you referring to, Scott?
Oh, well, we'll let that go. But, you know, it's a fairly common analysis, I think, in certain areas that it's like, well, you're subsidizing wind energy, you're subsidizing solar with a certain tariff, feed-in tariff and that. So, of course, the bill is high. Any truth to that, Mike? Or do you think – of course you're going to say no. But, I mean, is what – is there something to that thinking in terms of, you know, you're subsidizing this here and that's why it's going up? Like, I think a lot of people can't get their heads around as to why the bill has gone up, other than the fact that the sunshine list just gets larger every year. That's part of it, in my view. But is it these larger wind deals?
Well, it's
and that?
The same with water bills, too.
Well, that's right. You're conserving so much. We need to charge you more.
Yeah.
So it's faulty.
Absolutely. So first of all, it's infuriating that our bills would go up because we're saving energy. And so to me, that's a fundamental problem that's happened with conventional electricity planning in this province. The folks running the system keep saying electricity use is going to go up, up, and up, and up, and up. And that's why we need to build more capacity. And whether that capacity is wind or solar or nuclear or water power, whatever. And what they haven't realized is that actually, their predictions have always, for the most part, been wrong. Mm. They've always overpredicted the amount of energy we need because they don't take into account conservation, energy efficiency, the fact that our economy is becoming more efficient. And so it infuriates me. The second point is that it actually shows you the challenges of having an inflexible system. Part of the problem in Ontario is we have three nuclear plants that are inflexible power. They're either on or off, producing thousands of megawatts. And so you can't do small adjustments to take into account fluctuations in supply and demand. So when you have an overabundance of power that's inflexible, then when demand goes down, you can't make adjustments for it. And so according to the Ontario Energy Board, which is independent, and I don't know of anybody who would claim that the Ontario Energy Board is an environmental organization or a green organization or anything like that. The primary driver of increases in our electricity bills is what's called the global adjustment. And it's that confusing thing that is basically contracted power. 46% of the increase in the global adjustment is due to investments in or money spent on nuclear, 6% due to renewable energy. So there actually isn't even enough renewable energy capacity in the grid for it mathematically to be possible for that being the primary driver of the reason electricity rates are going up. And so, you know, let's have an honest conversation. Of course, any new power generation investment is going to increase prices, whether it's wind, solar, nuclear, what have you. But it's the money being spent on nuclear that's driving up prices much more than money being spent on renewable energy.
Well, and that's something you and the Greens have called for too, isn't it? The full and independent review of the public costs and the alternatives to rebuilding Bruce B. and Darlington, and you suggested that the hydro from Quebec would be a good idea. But I remember well when the Greens first getting started 25 years ago, one of the big issues was that we shouldn't spend money on the retrofit of Darlington, or maybe it was Pickering at that time. I can't even remember. But the story is the same. And the bill is the same too. It's billions of dollars. So any movement towards that? I mean, you've proposed that. Do you see that happening, a full review of nuclear in Ontario, or is the cabal, the lobby, too great? Because we seem so tied to nuclear. It's like we almost seem like we have to have it. It's like some kind of fail somehow as a nation if we don't have a nuclear plant roiling away somewhere. But ask the Japanese whether they think the same thing. Anyway, so.
Yeah, so the Green Party continues to push for an independent public review. I've pushed in some places and I'm hoping that at some point in time in the future, we're going to have a positive answer. I can't say that publicly now, whether or not it's going to happen. I don't know if it will or not, but we've certainly made those kinds of requests and we continue to push for it. And the reality for me is no nuclear project in Ontario's history has ever delivered on time or on budget. Mm-hmm. No private insurance company will insure a nuclear plant because the risks are too high. And we currently have no solution for dealing with the waste. And so as a small business owner or anybody who runs a business or maybe even your household budget, would you ever spend money on something that literally never delivers on time or budget? Like, really, would you do it? And so at the very least, wouldn't you like want to do an analysis of the cost, the alternatives, and actually be able to make an informed decision around what is the most affordable, clean source of power that we have?
Is that going to be something like that even going to be possible now because the hydro is partially privatized? Like, I think in the end, it'll only be 60% owned by the province. And the public accountability might not be there if a little less than half of the ownership stake is a private corporation or private corporations, private citizens.
Yeah, so one, I've been vocally opposed to the privatization of Hydro One, and But that's the transmission and distribution, mm-hmm. which is different than the generation. So when it comes to nuclear power, part of it's being privately managed, Bruce Power and Kincardine, mm-hmm. and some of it's being publicly managed by OPG, Ontario Power Generation, which would be Darlington and Pickering.
Right.
So that's separate than the Hydro One issue. Mm-hmm. And so from my perspective, you know, every study I've seen has shown that we could get water power from Quebec at a third of the price of what a rebuilt Darlington would cost. So why wouldn't we explore that? If it's less money, it's clean power, certainly more flexible than what you get from a nuclear plant. And whether or not it's the answer, I think a study before you literally commit $13 billion to rebuilding Darlington, if history is any indication, on average, nuclear plants go 2.5 times over budget, that $13 billion could quickly turn into $32 billion. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should spend that kind of money without at least doing a cost comparison, or at least mm-hmm. studying the alternatives and trying to figure out what is the most affordable, best way to keep the lights on.
And it's funny, too, I mean, leaving costs aside, but a lot of people who are, I guess, maybe trying to find a middle between the environmentalists and the business people looking for solutions or compromises will say, well, nuclear is clean burning, you know. There's no emissions from nuclear. And you were hitting pretty hard against this in the by-election that happened earlier this year, Whitby, Oshawa, which, of course, is home base for Darlington. To people who may be thinking, that's a good compromise, what's your response?
Well, first of all, you can get emission-free electricity from existing Quebec water power at a third of the price of a rebuilt Darlington. So, you know, the question is not necessarily around, you know, where do you get electricity that doesn't produce carbon pollution? Mm-hmm. It's where do you get it in the most affordable, reliable, flexible way? Mm-hmm. And I think most of the studies show that nuclear isn't the way to do it. Plus, all of the talk about it being emission-free doesn't take into account the emissions from uranium mining, mm-hmm. the trucking of uranium, the processing of uranium, the amount of cement that goes into rebuilding a nuclear facility, the storage of the waste. Like, there's a whole host of other issues that clearly indicate that nuclear power is not clean power. And I realize that, you know, water power is not perfect either. Solar power is not perfect either. Wind power is not. Every source of power generation has some negative effects on the environment, et cetera. So what you need to look at is, so which has the least negative effect and what's the most affordable? And you know what the best answer is? Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm so outraged about hydro rates going up. It's conservation. Mm. It's actually the energy we don't use. And that's oftentimes what we fail to talk about in Ontario, is the fact that saving energy saves money. If you want to reduce your electricity bill, save energy. People in New York State, on a per capita basis, use energy 35% more efficiently than we do in Ontario. Mm-hmm. They're not living in the dark. Mm-hmm. I think they have smartphones and computers and lights and manufacturing facilities and things like that.
That's not what I heard.
Well, maybe not. I don't know.
Buffalo, anyway.
Buffalo. Well, maybe Buffalo is the exception. I don't know.
But hey, they seem like Buffalo. Anyway.
Buffalo's got some good points. There's no doubt about it. But anyway, they live a lifestyle pretty much similar to what we do here in Ontario. I mean, I realize folks who live in the far north would argue that it's a bit colder up there. But mm-hmm. for those of us in southern Ontario, it's not that much different, really. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, why did they use electricity 35% more efficiently than we do here in Ontario? Imagine if we actually planned our system out properly and we could reduce or become 35% more efficient. That would make our businesses more competitive. It'd lower their energy bills. It'd lower your you know, home heating and electricity bills, saving you money, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what makes it so infuriating that our electricity prices are actually going to go, our rates, I should say, are going to go up because we saved energy. Like, it just makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, let's not get the Toronto Sun started on the problems of wind power.
No.
Anyway, so we're going to take a break here. Speaking of energy, we're going to conserve some and come back fresh after the break. We're going to play a bit of music, a bit of a tribute if you've heard the news today, and some commercials as well. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're tuned in to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, and around the world.
Needs no introduction. That was Prince from his album Around the World, and that album's known for Raspberry Beret, among others. That was America. That's probably as close as Prince got to social comment, although it seems he may have hundreds and hundreds of songs not yet released, and if you were living under a rock, you probably haven't heard, but Prince, dead at the age of 57, cause unknown as of yet, but it's been a really, really bad year for the rock and rollers, among others. Well, that's for sure.
It's been a bad year for everybody.
China's gone. China the wrestler.
I thought you meant the country.
No,
when
China
did that
is. And in other news, China is gone. No. Yeah, so.
She died earlier today.
Another, she was 40 something, 46?
She was young.
Man, I tell you.
You know, with Gary Shandling, Alan Rickman,
Bowie and
Merle Haggard. Yeah, it's been a brutal year. Somebody put on Twitter after it was announced that they said, is this the final season for Earth? Because they're killing off all the good characters.
Maybe. You never know.
Let's hope not. Holy.
No. Which I thought, well, that's a good segue for today's show. well, actually, no, I do want to share this because I found this on CBC the other day. They're saying that, first of all, the ice caps... the melting of the ice caps is wreaking havoc on the ocean's very structure. And that was the headline. And the point of it was this guy at the York University. First of all, in Greenland, the caps are melting at a rate of 8,300 tons per second. And that... It's looking like, and it's apparently provable on satellite, it's having an effect on the Earth's gravitational field.
Yeah.
And this is like, this sounds like something out of Star Trek. You're like, you want to yell down to the engine room about, like, to Mr. Scott, to, like, do something with the warp core to change the gravitational
Data
field.
Data will do a calculation and it'll be
This sounds completely messed up. And I read that and then I was watching the news and it was like something about Ted Cruz saying something stupid. I'm like, forget Ted Cruz. The gravitational field of the Earth is changing. It's almost like the problem is too big to comprehend now.
You know, it is. That's one of the big challenges with the climate crisis is that it's almost so huge and so enormous that people feel like, oh, what can I do?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was earlier today, I was in McMaster speaking at an event around sustainable local food, which, you know, Guelph obviously is the center of great local food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I told the folks that, you know, one of the things that you can do that's very empowering is just with your choices of what you eat, you know, three times a day, or in my case, six times a day. I like to snack, which maybe it shows. I don't know.
It's radio. We're okay.
It's radio. We're good. That's right. It's not TV.
Looking good.
I'm looking good.
It's looking great.
So, you know, if you choose to eat local, you know, not only is it good for the environment, but it's also good for our economy because it keeps jobs mm-hmm. in Ontario, keeps our dollars in Ontario. And I know that that's not going to be the only solution.
Right.
You know, reducing your meat consumption, those types of things are all part of it. That's not the only solution, but that's a huge part of it. And that's something that we can do every day. Mm-hmm. And so that might be easier than changing the way you get to work, you know, like whether mm-hmm. you drive or take transit or whatever. So as we sort of look at these bigger societal shifts that need to happen, eating local sustainable food and supporting local sustainable farmers is something you can do starting today.
Yeah. I do get that. And then on Saturday, you're going to have different neighborhoods in Guelph, you know, cleaning up their local parks and picking up all the litter. And I think that stuff's great. But I remember as a kid when Earth Day came around, the sort of buzz phrase was act locally, think globally.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, when I hear some of the statistics about the earth changes and lengthy droughts in places, huge floods in places that are getting like once in a lifetime floods every year, I just think, you know, yeah, we think locally, but it just almost seems like it's not enough anymore.
Yeah, well, we can't deny the problem anymore because it's already affecting us. I mean, you know, one concrete thing is just, you know, your home insurance rates are going up.
Mm.
And it used to be crime and fire would be why your home insurance rate went up. Mm-hmm. Now the reason they're going up, extreme weather events due to climate change. So we are starting to experience it in our day-to-day lives. We have to take action to solve the problem. But there is, on the other side, side of the coin, there is a good news story here too, is you know, this could be one of the biggest economic opportunities in terms of job creation that we've seen maybe, you know, in our lifetimes, is the work that's going to be required to solve the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can create employment. We can shift to a low-carbon economy with good-paying jobs, but we'll need a policy framework in which to do that. And the first step, I think, and the most critical step, is finally putting a real price on carbon pollution.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be the only step. Like, it's going to take a bigger shift than that. But that's a huge one. Let's start saying, you know what? Pay for what you burn. Pay for your pollution, not for what you earn.
The Prime Minister's going to New York tomorrow to sign the Paris Agreement.
That's right. Do you think, big day.
Yeah. Well, it is a big day. I don't deny it. 150 countries. Do you think that is going to have any far-reaching implications, or is this going to be another piece of paper that we kind of put in a drawer?
Both. So it is going to – no, seriously, it's going to have far-reaching implications because for the first time, you know, 150 countries are coming together and saying we have to do something about the crisis. So that's a huge step forward. But there's nothing legally binding that's going to force them to meet targets. And so that's where, you know, the real shift is going to happen. And that's where the hard decisions, like what Ontario is going through right now with the cap and trade bill, is how do you design solutions that actually work and don't give a free exemption to polluters?
Oh, somebody's wanted.
The bat phone.
I want to talk about some local concerns, I mean, because we are a Guelph show, but one of the things that's coming up for the discussion, I'm not sure how much you're aware of it, I'm sure you are fairly aware of it, but the Community Energy Initiative, it's coming up for discussion on Monday night. The mayor made some waves a couple of weeks ago talking about what a waste of money it's been, and, you know, we're talking about so much money about getting, you know, clean, sustainable energy when it could be going to actually funding energy. And I want to get your thoughts on it because it seems like it's going to be a pretty substantial, I don't want to say showdown, but it seems like there's probably going to be some pretty heavy discussion
sparks
on Monday night about it. Sparks will fly. Let's say sparks will fly.
we'll see. But so first of all, I'm a big supporter of local energy solutions. I mean, if you look in Guelph, we ship $500 million out of this community to buy energy to bring into it.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we can keep those dollars in Guelph, the more we can create those jobs in Guelph, the better it is for Guelph's economy and the better it is for our environment. Now, we have to make sure that we have the proper oversights in place to make sure that the investments we are making in community energy are delivering the financial and environmental returns that we want.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that community energy you know, is not the way forward, I think is wrong. It is the way forward. It just needs to be implemented and done in the right way. And it was, you know, Guelph's been a leader for a decade now at the forefront of community energy planning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is time to update the Community Energy Initiative to make sure that what Guelph, to see what we've accomplished in the last 10 years, you know, where we made mistakes, where we had successes, and to use that to inform where the direction we want to go over the next decade. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very supportive in an update of the Community Energy Initiative, and to make and as part of that update, doing an evaluation of what we've done over the past decade to guide us in our decision making over the next decade.
I almost feel like it's the garbage issue all over again, because I remember when they introduced three stream here, it seemed to be like what people hated the idea was actually taking the extra second to decide what bag you're going to throw it in or what bin you're going to throw it in. And I feel like people just wanted to go back to the good old days where they could throw all everything in one big black bag and you put it on your curb and away it goes. God knows
where. Throw it in the river or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like this is the same way. It's, you know, it's not just a matter of you go to the Home Depot and you get a box of bulbs. You have to go and get, you know, like the right kind of bulbs. It's going to save you energy. You know, you have to go and buy the right low flow toilet. It just seems like it's putting more onus on the people to make sure they make smart energy choices. And people don't like that. They want to put everything in the big black bag and send it away.
Well, I mean, part of it is it's hard to make changes in your day-to-day lifestyle.
Yeah.
For anyone. I mean, geez, you know, like so many people are like me. You know, I'm middle-aged. I've got kids. I'm trying to pay the mortgage, trying to get my kids to school, get lunch, get dinner. Like, you know, don't make my life too complicated. So I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But that's why we need a policy framework that creates the right incentives to make it easy for people to make choices that actually address the crisis that we're facing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, making it easy and affordable to retrofit your home and invest in energy efficient appliances to save you money and save you energy, that's a great way forward. Making it easier for people to put things like solar panels on their roof so they can make money actually producing energy. Those types of local initiatives can be good for our economy, mm-hmm. and good for our environment, provided they're managed properly.
I don't know why all houses don't come with solar panels now. I mean, that may be overly simplistic of me, but it just seems like we're always building houses. Why aren't we just putting the solar panels on them?
Actually, it's interesting. San Francisco just passed a law requiring all new buildings to have solar panels on them.
Well, there you go. Head of the curve again.
There you go.
Takes a California to drive everything. So you briefly touched on garbage there, Adam. And just before airtime, I met somebody who had a question for Mike, which I wasn't able to go into too much detail as to the meat of it. So Mike will be able to tell me. He mentioned Bill 151, the Waste-Free yes. Ontario Act. And this particular guy was very excited about this because I think it affects his day-to-day specifically. And he mentioned something about a circular economy. Mm-hmm. And they're calling this the Circular Economy Act. The impression I got from what he was saying, that the idea is that the waste stream does become more circular and that we've got our three bins. But, I mean, I hope to God they come up with a way to, you know, the plastic bag full of fruit. That's my sort of personal beef is like, you know, you're eating fruit and it's organic and you might get hepe. That's another story. But, you know, it's like you're just inundated with these plastic bags. And it's like, when will we get to the day where that doesn't, you know, that bag just isn't going to end up in the ocean somewhere?
Yes.
That's the impression I got. And this was like a very brief conversation. So, Mike, tell us about the Waste-Free Ontario Act, because it does sound like progressive legislation.
Yeah, so there are many things good about the legislation. And again, it's another bill that's before committee right now at Queen's Park. There are some problems I'll talk about as well. But the basic concept behind the circular economy is there is no garbage. Let's turn garbage into gold.
Sounds great.
It's basically like we are throwing away valuable resources. Why are we wasting this? And so it's about how do we create a more efficient society? How do we create a more efficient economy that's going to, you know, essentially – you know, you can turn it into money, like literally turn garbage into gold. Mm-hmm. And so that's one huge economic opportunity out of it. Another important component of it is what's known as an individual producer responsibility. And it's the basic concept saying, why are we as taxpayers subsidizing companies to produce garbage through our property taxes? That's what we're doing. And so individual producer responsibility says that if you're a company and you produce garbage and you produce waste through packaging, et cetera, the way you design your products, et cetera, you pay for that. Taxpayers are no longer going to subsidize your poor design decisions, your poor packaging. You know, the times you get, you know, you buy something little tiny and it's in this huge plastic package. It's just like, what a waste. This infuriates me.
Don't get me started. Then, I bought an SD card last week.
Exactly.
And I had to like practically shoot the plastic off of it to get in.
And so we pay for that through our property taxes. So I think it's ridiculous that taxpayers are subsidizing this. And so it's basically saying, you know what? We're not going to subsidize anymore. Companies, you're responsible for it. And then the great thing about the marketplace is those innovative companies will say, well, hey, you know, we're going to save money by reducing packaging. We're going to be more competitive, and we're going to out-compete our competitors. And so it's really a market – it's also a market-based solution to an important – economic and environmental problem. And so I'm very excited about it. And so it's something we've been advocating for. It's good to see Ontario moving this direction. One of my concerns in Bill 151, though, is that it proposes to privatize environmental inspections. And I see that as hugely problematic. Whenever we, you know, there's certain things the private sector does better than the public sector. There's no doubt about it. But there's certain things the public sector does better than the private sector. And one of them is inspections when it comes to, you know, labor or environment or health and safety, things like that. And so that's one aspect of the legislation I disagree with. You know, privatizing environmental inspections is the wrong way to go. And so there's good and bad in that legislation, and hopefully in the through the committee process and the amendment process, we'll keep the good things and get rid of the bad things.
How far along is that bill right now?
It just finished committee hearings this week.
Okay.
And so it'll probably be quickly moving to clause-by-clause review by committee.
And it's a good point, too, that I think we often forget about is market-based solutions and trying to develop those. I mean, and we're seeing that south of the border on social issues, you know, these states that are passing these stringent anti-gay, anti-trans legislation, and the businesses say, PayPal in North Carolina, for instance, saying, well, we're not going to be doing any expansion there.
Exactly.
And money talks.
And every musician said, we're not playing there, pretty much.
Pretty much,
exactly.
Jimmy Buffett, I think, but anyway.
I mean, we can, with the right types of rules in our economy, we can actually create a number of market-based solutions to address, I think, social justice issues and environmental issues as well.
Mm-hmm. While you're here, I want to just, because we talked about it last week, address something non-environmental, which is the fundraising thing. Well, I know it's a passion
absolutely.
Of yours.
Very big passion of mine.
So, you know, you had a meeting with Premier Nguyen last week. Is this a situation where she's feeling the burn, to so to speak, to do something about it, or is there a feeling like she got her hand caught in the cookie jar and now she's going to be completely anti-cookie?
Well, first of all, I think most people agree that Ontario's political fundraising rules stink. And you know, the Liberals have taken this to a whole new level. I mean, the whole idea that a cabinet minister would have a $500,000 fundraising quota, and they're raising most of that money from industry, from either corporations or unions in which their ministry kind of oversees, it just opens up so many problems. And so it just doesn't pass the stink test.
For sure.
And I think people are sick of it. And actually, I think the burn that's happening in the U.S. is maybe flowing over into Ontario a little bit. And people are saying, hey, if they're talking about getting big money out of, you know, U.S. politics, why aren't we getting big money out of Ontario politics? And so, you know, that's, for me, one of my top issues right now is just hammer. You know, we need a democratic system that people can have confidence in. The government decisions are not being influenced by big money, that people don't have to buy access to power. That has to end. And so I had a very positive meeting with the Premier, actually, very constructive meeting around some of the substantive reforms we're looking for. I mean, first of all, we should just ban corporate and union donations, period. We need to put restrictions on third-party advertising. We need to lower contribution limits. And then the big one that I'm really advocating for is a democratic public financing system. Right now, we have public financing of political parties, but it's a pay-to-play system.
Yeah.
So as an example, if you donate $2,500 to a political party, you get almost half that back in tax credits. So that's really a public financing system that benefits those with deep pockets.
Yeah.
So you pay to play. I'd rather move to a vote-to-play system where you say, you know what, my vote directs where I want my political donation to go. Very similar to what we had at the federal level, where like a $2 per vote funding and would fund political parties for the most part. You'd still get individual donations. And the good thing about that is if you want decisions made in the public interest, the public should be paying for or partially paying the funding of political parties, but it should be done in a democratic way, not in the current system, which is really benefiting those with deep pockets.
For sure. It is interesting that there seems to be a bit of a double standard because they announced new legislation for overseeing municipal elections a couple of weeks ago. And in there is an option for municipalities to ban third-party money, to ban union and corporate donations. But it, I guess something clicked that made them say, like, maybe we should consider that for ourselves.
Well, I think part of it's just the outrage. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I've got to hand it to you. Investigative journalism is important, eh? And so both the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail, but especially the Star, have done some really good investigative journalism over the last little while, showing you know, raising, you know, issues around political donations, particularly the government. I mean, the fact that Bruce Power would have a $100,000 private dinner with the premier and the energy minister, and then a year and a half later, the Liberals give them an untendered contract to rebuild, worth $13 billion to rebuild Bruce Nuclear. Whether that $100,000 dinner had an influence on that decision or not, like, we don't know. And, you know, I don't want to say it did.
Well.
But it sure stinks. Like, it raises a lot of questions, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this area in this hour. The Earth is falling apart. The gravitational field is being destroyed.
But don't lose hope.
Well, that's my question.
I don't lose hope. I'm an eternal optimist. I would not be doing what I do if I wasn't optimistic that we can make changes. You know, I tell you what. Being leader of a political party that doesn't have a seat at Queen's Park is not an easy job. And some people have even said to me, it's like, why are you doing this? You know, you could be elected as a Liberal, Conservative, or NDP, or like, why don't you? But we need somebody who's going to stand on principle. We need a political party that's going to be about honesty, integrity, and put good public policy first. And that may not be the easy road, but for me, it's the right road. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't optimistic that we could seize the opportunities and take on the challenges and do it successfully, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
It's funny you should say that because I did an interview with Kelly Smith, who works for Transition Guelph,
right,
a couple of weeks ago.
Great organization.
And I asked her the same question. I'm like, are you optimistic about the future? She says, no, not really. It's interesting because I have to admit I would like to be more optimistic about the future, but I have like an anklet around my ankle that's chained to a wall called pessimism, and it's just I'm not sure, but I'm glad you're optimistic. It makes me feel good that at least there's someone optimistic in politics and not completely cynical yet.
Absolutely. So ask me again after the next provincial election. But anyway, you know what? We've even without a seat at Queen's Park, the Green Party's made a huge difference on a number of pieces of legislation, everything from restoring funding to the Experimental Lakes area to restrictions on neonicotinoid pesticides to carbon pricing to things like, you know, fighting the Melanchthon mega quarry. I'm hoping we're going to be successful one of these days in the Dolheim quarry here in Guelph, which is another passion of mine. So we've been successful on a number of issues. I think we're going to be successful on cleaning up big money in politics. So those are victories in and of themselves, just knowing that even if you don't hold power, you can make a difference, and you can make a difference by engaging and mobilizing people to speak out for what's right.
Great lesson, and I think that's a great positive point to leave it on. So, Mike, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they reach out to you on your various social media things? Because I know you're always on those, like
sure.
me.
Well, I respond to you, Adam, whenever
yeah, you
ask
do.
Me a question
that's
on Twitter. True. So, at Mike Schreiner on Twitter. You can always go to gpo.ca for our website. And, you know, you can send me an email anytime, leader@gpo.ca. I give out my cell phone number a fair amount. Maybe I won't do it on air, but... But there's many ways to contact me, and you know, people probably see me all over town, various cafes and places like that where I meet with people, and so I'm always open to having meetings with concerned citizens.
And tree planting this Saturday, am I right?
Yes, Rotary Forest. Every year, the Green Party, we're the only political party that actually raises money to donate to a good cause. But we do a campaign every spring around Earth Day where a certain percentage of the donations that come into the party, we're giving to the Guelph Rotary for the Rotary Forest. And so I'll be out planting trees Saturday morning by Guelph Lake.
Share the love. Excellent.
Walking the walk.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate your time this Earth Day, Mike. Thanks for coming in, and we hope to have you back sometime soon.
My pleasure.
And that is it for this week's edition of Open Sources Guelph. Next week, we will be having Lloyd Longfield on. And then the week after that, Phil Ault will be in studio. So if you have any questions for either of those guys, feel free to get in touch with us at opensourcesguelph.com. Open Sources Newswire on Facebook at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, you can listen to the Open Sources Guelph podcast on Podbean at the Guelph Politicast channel on whatever fine podcast listening device you listen to us on. And you can get in touch with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
And I'm at Scotty Hertz on Twitter and Scotty Hertz on Facebook, and I blog at the Spanner Book, but nothing's happened lately after that previous explosion, so we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, you really sent it out there that time. It was too much.
I'm completely drained now. I got nothing. So. No, there's always something, so anyway. Stay tuned.
Yeah, and speaking of staying tuned, DJ Sounds Good to Me is at the top of the hour with a previously enjoyed episode here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for Open Sources Guelph, be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more. We'll see you then.
Happy Earth Day.